Okay, so this is where we were as of this morning. So we were talking about null rays defined in terms of an underlying, you know, physics picture coming from Maxwell's equations. So the normal to the surfaces of constant phase, so the normal to phase fronts, is the vector k. Maxwell's equations tell us that this vector is null, and those two things together tell us that the vector field is actually geodesic. And then the idea is that, well, in order to work out what happens, you know, in terms of the relative behavior of the congruence of null geodesics, that behavior is going to be, you know, encoded in the gradient of the tangent vector k. We've introduced a decomposition of this in terms of pieces that are going to be along k or partially orthogonal to k and along k, and then the fully orthogonal piece that's going to be orthogonal to both k and any choice of n that that we want to provide in terms of a second null direction. And you know, with an emphasis placed on the purely transverse part of this, because that's what's really describing the relative behavior of one null geodesic relative to a neighboring one. So that's the idea of introducing a decomposition of grad k, and then we further decompose that thing over here in terms of, you know, trace and trace-free parts in the sort of usual way without breaking the fact that this tensor has to be purely transverse. So what we have at our disposal here to define what might be trace and trace-free is, of course, not the full metric, because that's not purely transverse, but the projection operator omega, that's something that is, you know, purely transverse. So we can, you know, we can define a decomposition like this in terms of trace and trace-free pieces without violating the transverse property of the tensor using that projection operator. And then, you know, then the theta, the expansion scalar, we're going to give it an interpretation in just a few minutes. That's going to be defined to be the trace of that tensor, but defined relative to that projection operator. And sigma is going to be what remains after you take out the trace, so it's going to be the trace-free part of that tensor. And the idea is that this is the thing that has physical relevance, that describes the transverse behavior of the congruence, and we broke it down into pieces that will have a simple, you know, simple interpretation in terms of an expansion scalar that measures the fractional rate of change of cross-sectional areas, and then something that measures the rate at which the little areas that we can form by attaching them to the null geodesics undergo a shear deformation. All right, so that's the stuff that we talked about this morning, and that's where we were before we broke. And what I want to do for the first part of the lecture is to go, you know, look at this through a couple of examples just to get the idea behind what this all means. Before I do that, I'm going to work out a more explicit expression for theta by just working out the right-hand side. And we're going to see what we get from that. So the idea is that we're going to relate theta to the actual divergence of the vector field. So that's the, you know, that's the identity that I want to prove now. Okay, so I'll start here, and then we'll show that this is actually equal to our theta quantity defined in this way. So I'll do the calculation on this side over here. So I want to calculate the divergence of the vector field, so I'll do it as the fully contracted version of the grad k tensor. And what I'll do is to, well, decompose that in the way that we normally do. So I'll solve for the metric here, and what I will get is minus k alpha n beta minus n alpha k beta plus the projection operator, and that's going to be acting on the gradient tensor. And then all the usual things happen, right? So k alpha multiplying this gives us zero because of the geodesic equation. K beta multiplying this gives us zero because k is a null vector. So the only thing that survives in that right-hand side is going to be the projection operator acting on the full gradient. And then all we have to do is to insert the decomposition of the full gradient. And because I'm applying the projection operator to that, of course, only the transverse part will survive, and we're going to be back here. So the next step is to just apply the decomposition where we have B, K alpha, K beta, and then we have K alpha B perp beta B perp alpha K beta plus the fully transverse part of the tensor. And then, of course, when we multiply through, K is orthogonal to omega, K is orthogonal to omega, K is orthogonal to omega, so none of this survives except the last term, and that's exactly what defined theta in the first place. So theta is something that's easy to calculate because you don't need to, do all of this decomposition stuff. You can get to it directly by taking the divergence of the vector field, so that's a nice shortcut. But if you want the shear tensor and if you want the other pieces of the decomposition, then you have to do a bit more work because now you have to introduce the n vector, you have to calculate the projection operator, and in order to get the shear tensor, you have to define this, you have to calculate that, so there's more there's more to it to calculate this, but this is something that is directly accessible to a quick calculation, so that's I think nice. It's nice to know. So theta, a quantity of fundamental importance here, is simply the divergence of the tangent vector field, which was exactly what it was in the time-like case. So that, is a result that gets preserved as we go from the time-like case to the null case. So that's a nice, correspondence that we have. Otherwise, everything is, more complicated when we go from time-like to null, and you have to do all of the extra stuff in addition. Okay, so that's the mathematical description of congruences in fair, in fair detail, in fair amount of generality, except for the fact that I'm restricting my tangent vector field to be a gradient field. So that's an important restriction that the geometric optics underpinning of this gives us. But as I warned you this morning, there are congruences of null geodesics in various spacetimes that don't share that property, that are not coming from a geometric optics description, and for which the tangent vector field would still be geodesic and null, but not not a gradient field. And that means in that kind of context that the grad tensor is not symmetric. So there are lots of other terms that would show up in the decomposition, and in particular the decomposition for B now would include an antisymmetric piece that would describe the relative rotation between the null geodesics. So that's as a warning, because as I know, the next homework assignment will have things of that nature in it. So you'll have a non-zero omega tensor, so you just need to generalize things appropriately to handle that. Okay, so let's look at a few examples where we're going to have the symmetry preserved. So let's look at null cones in Schwarzschild. So I've already worked through the null cone in Minkowski spacetime in fair detail, so I don't think I need to go back into this. So we'll just do the Schwarzschild example here, which is nice. How to spell that. All right, so the metric, we all know, takes this form, and d omega squared is my, is standard notation for the metric on a unit two sphere, so I think you know what that is. And then if we're talking about Schwarzschild, f is the usual metric function that goes to zero on the event horizon. Okay, so what I want to do here is to define one type of null surface that's going to be our preferred null direction. That's going to be the outgoing null cones. But I'll do it simultaneously with the ingoing light cones that would, give us that will give us the other null direction that we're going to use to define the vector n. So to identify the null directions, well, I'm going to assume that the null geodesics and the surfaces that they come with are going to be spherically symmetric. So we're not going to be concerned about this. We're going to think of those null surfaces as living in the TR subplane of the Schwarzschild metric. And to identify those null directions, all we have to do is to find a way to factorize this into two null directions. And the idea is this. So I'm going to have an overall factor of minus f that comes from the, you know, from the dt squared term. And I'm going to write the first part of the metric as follows. In that factorized form, that is equivalent to what I had over here, and then I have the rest of it over here. So that, I think you can work out, right? We have, when we multiply this, we have dt squared that comes with a minus f in front. That gives us that. And then we have minus 1 over f squared dr squared that comes with this extra factor of minus f, and that gives that 1 over f dr squared. So that's exactly the same metric as we had before. But the idea is that if we're assuming that we're not moving in the angular direction, then we're going to get null directions whenever ds squared is equal to 0. And what we learn here is that we have two ways of making this happen. Either we set that to 0, that's, you know, that's going to give us one null direction in that spacetime. And here's another one that we get by putting that equal to 0. So what I notice here is that this is a perfect differential. I can integrate this with, you know, this one with respect to t, this one with respect to r. So that's a perfect differential that I'll call du. And setting du equal to 0 gives us one of our null directions, and that's going to be the outgoing null direction. And this is another perfect differential that I can, you know, integrate. And that's going to give us the other null direction. So u, if I do the integration, u is going to be defined to be t minus the integral of 1 over f dr. So I'm integrating a function of r, I get some other function of r. That function of r typically is called r star, so I'll call it that. And v is going to be, by integration of this, it's going to be t plus r star. And r star is just what I defined it to be. It's the integral of dr over f. And that's something that can be worked out. In fact, might as well put it in. It's an explicit function of r that comes straight out of doing the integral. All right. So if I, you know, if I could try to put this in pictures.
Can I have a question? Sorry.
Yes, please.
If d omega is not 0.
Right.
Then still du dv are perfect differentials? Complete differentials?
So I still have that term in the metric. That's fine. What I'm saying is that if I'm restricting myself to radial displacements in the spacetime for which theta and phi are not changing, then by factorizing this first part of the metric, I can identify the null directions. If I'm talking about null rays that also move in theta and phi, then of course that, you know, that doesn't work out, that doesn't apply. That's a more complicated situation. Does that answer
okay.
your question?
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, good. Right, so if I try to put this in pictures, what I have here is something that in flat spacetime would reduce to t minus r. So those are the light cones we were talking about before. Those are the outgoing light cones. This in flat spacetime would be t plus r. Those would correspond to converging null cones, you know, incoming null cones. So if I were to draw a picture of this, the outgoing null cones in Schwarzschild spacetime would look more or less like they do in I don't think the picture is gonna be terribly meaningful. So I'll just draw them as, you know, standard null cones like we had before, except that you know, there's a deformation of the null cones curve, you know, coming from that log term that describes the fact that light takes a bit longer to propagate out of a gravitational well. That's this logarithmic term that describes this. But other than that, and because the picture is schematic anyway, so I can draw those light cones to be identical to flat light cones. And the light rays that we're talking about here would be the ones that are tangent to each light cone like this. And those are light rays that move with constant values of theta and phi. So basically the direct analog to what we were talking about before in the flat example. So those are outgoing light rays, outgoing light cones, I should say. And the other ones, the vehicle constant surfaces, that's not going to be my focus here, but we can describe them also as basically incoming light cones that instead of diverging away from r equals zero, they converge to r equals zero. So here we're talking about null cones that converge in as opposed to expand out. So those are vehicle constant surfaces. And those are incoming null cones. So by doing this little bit of algebra here, we have identified the two main null directions of the Schwarzschild spacetime. And what I want to do is to take this to be my surface S. And the tangent vectors here are going to be my vector k. And, well, to identify that, well, that's a pretty easy thing to do. We know that k is going to be minus the gradient of that surface. So I used to call it s, now I call it u. So in the coordinates that we're given, you know, u is the same thing as t minus r star. So the time component of the gradient is going to be 1. Or I should say minus 1 with the minus 1 inserted. And then the radial component is going to be the derivative of r star, which is 1 over f. And then there are no components along theta and phi. So that's the vector k with the index down that describes the gradient of the surface u. And then if I raise the index on this using the Schwarzschild metric, well, that minus 1 is going to be converted into a 1 over f. When I invert the Schwarzschild metric, that minus f after inversion will become 1 over minus f. So that's what I have here. And when I raise the index here, the 1 over f will be raised with an f, the inverse of that f minus 1 that appears here. So that goes into a 1, and I still have 0 entries for the angular components. So that's the vector corresponding to that covector. And when I stare at this, well, I automatically have a description of the geodesics. So the geodesics are going to be described by those equations here to tell me that the derivative of the time coordinate with respect to the parameter lambda along the geodesic is going to be the time component of the vector, therefore 1 over f. And then dr d lambda, that's going to be the radial component of the vector, and that's going to be 1. And that tells me right away that, well, the affine parameter is in fact the same thing as the radial coordinate. So so that's a nice way of describing the null geodesics. And then, well, the angular components are 0, so theta is constant, and phi is equal to a constant. If I want to integrate this and get the description of the geodesics, well, that equation turns into dt dr equals 1 over f. Therefore, dt is equal to dr over f. Therefore, t is equal to r star plus a constant. And of course, we're not surprised because, you know, those null geodesics are tangent to the surface u equal constant. Therefore, t is going to be equal to r star plus a constant, the constant being the value of u on that surface. And then that's the equation that tells us that lambda, the affine parameter on the null geodesic, can be identified with the radial coordinate r. All right, so it all hangs together very nicely. We have the normal vector, we have the tangent vector. We can straightforwardly compute the gradient of the normal vector. And if we do that calculation, then that requires, calculating the Christoffel symbols in Schwarzschild spacetime and working it all out. We get the following matrix. I'll just give you what the answer is. So for the time-time component, it's going to be minus m over r squared. That's m over r squared times f over here. It's symmetric, so it's got to be m over r squared times f over here as well. And here it's minus m over r squared f squared. And beyond all of this, we get a whole bunch of zeros. And over here we get r and r sine squared theta. And the idea here is that, well, here's a complicated matrix with presumably useful information in it and perhaps some less useful information in it. If we want to extract what is useful and what is not useful, what we have to do now is to introduce the decomposition that we can introduce for any situation like this. And that requires the introduction of an n vector that satisfies all of the properties that describes an alternative distinct null direction in the spacetime, and then working out the decomposition from that. And the first step, therefore, is going to be to identify a proper n vector, and that's where this additional null direction comes to the rescue, because, well, that's going to be a pretty good candidate, and in fact a perfectly fine candidate for that distinct null direction that doesn't match the direction of the null cones, but comes across the null cones coming in into the surface, hugging those incoming null cones instead. So what's going to be that vector? Well, that vector is going to be proportional to the gradient of surfaces of constant v. So my choice of alternative my choice of additional null direction will be, let's take it to be proportional to a surface of constant v. And the reason I say proportional and not equal is because I want to normalize this vector in a way that's going to match the requirements that we always make, which is that the n vector has to be a null vector. So that we already have, but it has to be normalized in such a way that it's in a product with k is minus 1. That's a choice we made at the outset to introduce the decomposition in the way that we have. We could have modified that and make it more general, but that would have complicated all the equations. So that's something we want to impose as a specific choice of normalization for a null vector. So that's why I can't, say too early or say at all that it has to be equal to the gradient, because that would violate that normalization condition. Okay, so, but if we work this out, then, well, it's almost the same vector as the one we had over here, except that, the minus r star has become a plus r star, so that will bring out a minus sign here. So the component of this is going to be that. And we see that if we try to take a scalar product between that vector here and this vector over here, we're going to get minus 1 over f minus 1 over f. So we're going to get minus 2 over f. And that's wrong by, a factor of 2 over f. So the trick is to just make up for that by, fixing the proportionality factor. So I'm going to say that this is going to be 1/2 times f times the vector I previously identified. And with that factor in front, now I don't have minus 2 over f anymore, I have minus 1, so everything is good in terms of normalization. Okay, so that's the idea. So we started out with one, favored null direction. Now we've introduced a distinct one. And once we have that, we can do the decomposition as we have over here, and we can calculate all of those things that appear in that decomposition. So I'm going to save the details here. I'm not going to do all of this, but I'm going to say that with this choice of null vector here, that's one choice. I mean, we could have done this in different ways. We could have introduced angular components to the n vector, and that would have been fine. But, there's no point in, doing something more complicated when something simple works. So that works. But if we do the decomposition according to, with that choice of null of n vector, then we calculate b, we can calculate all of those things. And what we find in this case is that b is m over r squared with a minus sign. And it basically accounts for all of that stuff that lives here, which is, according to our previous discussion, is useless information that doesn't tell us anything about the transverse behavior of the null geodesics, which is all contained in the angular component. So all of this over here along the angular component, that's where the transverse behavior takes place. All of this here tells us stuff that we don't really care about. But nevertheless, that's what that thing is. The vector b could be calculated, and in that case, it's actually zero. So that doesn't occur in the decomposition for this congruence for this space-time. And then what's left over? Well, what's left over is the purely transverse part of the vector gradient. And that's something that I would decompose along those lines. So I'll introduce that decomposition. And I know how to calculate theta because that's given to me directly by the divergence of k. So that's something I can calculate independently. And once I have theta, I can calculate the shear tensor by taking the difference between what's left and that trace term. And what happens in this particular situation here for this example is that transverse tensor over here takes the form of a purely trace term. The shear tensor actually vanishes. So the shear tensor vanishes in this case. So this is a situation where the null geodesics are moving out in spherical symmetry. So they expand out. They will, generate light cones that expand in surface as, we move out into the space-time. But they don't generate any distortion because it preserves the spherical symmetry. And that's why we see that the shear tensor is zero, because otherwise it would have to violate the spherical symmetry of the light cones. So what's theta? Well, theta, as usual, is the divergence of k, which is basically the trace of that matrix here in the full metric, and that happens to be equal to 2 over r, exactly what we got before in flat space time. And that has to do with the fact that the radial coordinate of the Schwarzschild spacetime was chosen wisely to be a measure of surface area on two spheres. So if we didn't choose that as a coordinate, we would get a different result. But we get that result because, that's the purpose of R, and that's to measure cross-sectional areas. And that's something that we can also, in exactly the same way, re-express as the fractional rate of change of area along the null cones. So as the light rays move out into the future, they encounter cross sections of this null cone that grows in size, and the fractional rate of change of the area as we follow this motion is measured by theta and can be expressed like that. So that's theta. And this guy over here, well, that's the purely transverse part of the metric after we eliminate the k and n directions. And that tensor, well, I think not too surprisingly, is going to be a whole bunch of zeros except for the two-dimensional subblock that lives in the purely angular direction, and what it does is to pick out the purely angular part of the metric. That is what is being identified as the purely transverse space, which is pretty natural given that we're dealing with light cones that are spherically symmetric. There's one direction along the null generators, you know, along the null rays. There's another null direction that goes across the light cones, but what remains in the purely orthogonal direction are, you know, the angular part, you know, is the subspace that's described by the angular coordinates varying theta and phi. So, yeah. So that spherically symmetric example, I think, illustrates all of those concepts pretty nicely and reinforces the fact that that theta, you know, expansion parameter here is something that has deep meaning in the physics of the light rays. It really describes how they, you know, they grow out in size as measured by this fractional rate of change of the area. So the light cones become bigger and bigger as we follow the motion of the null geodesics into the future. If we were to switch the order, you know, switch the identity of the vector fields, and if we had, you know, identified this as our preferred, you know, null hypersurfaces, then we would be talking about converging light cones that decrease in size as a result of the expansion. So the cross sections would be getting smaller and smaller. And for that null vector field, we would find an expansion coefficient that's actually negative, right? So that's, you know, that's a side calculation that you could do. Calculate the theta parameter, not for K, but for N, and you would find that, well, it pretty much describes that. There's a little bit of subtleties, but, you know, no need to be concerned about that. I think you get the meaning of this. Yep?
So these calculations are truly considered generic non-geodesic, right? As theta and phi as well.
Sorry, say again?
If you consider a generic geodesic, not just radial,
mm-hmm.
these are true, except that...
No. So that's restricted strictly to radial null rays. If I decide that my null geodesics should move in theta and phi, then the vector field is a lot different. And then, you know, there would be all sorts of complications that would come in.
But we still expect that as R goes to zero, then we get infinite theta, right? Even in that case.
I would think so, yeah. Yeah. If the light rays are, yeah, converging to a black hole, then yeah, there would be a singularity of the flow at the singularity, that's for sure. Yeah. So that.
I was just wondering, but because I'm expecting if you go to infinity, in that case, theta should be zero.
Yeah, it does tend to zero at infinity. So the null surfaces become increasingly planar as you go to infinity, and then the relative distance between geodesics doesn't change, right? So I always have to think about relative terms, not the overall scaling of the null cone. So that can be a source of deception, I guarantee you that. So yeah, it's always the relative behavior that matters here. All right, other questions about this example? Okay, so that was for Schwarzschild, and that was a case where things were pretty simple, but also a little bit boring because in the end, our grad K decomposition didn't have a shear term in it. So it would be nice to see a different example where we can see that coming out without introducing too many complications. And I think I found a nice little example that illustrates this. So let's do another example. And that's a bit more exotic. We're going to do some anisotropic cosmology. And what do I mean by that? I'm going to make up a universe that expands differently in all three directions. So why not? It's not our universe, but, you know, it's a perfectly fine space-time. So the metric I will introduce here will have three different scaling factors, one for each of the three dimensions. So there's going to be a scaling factor that I'm calling A, in front of dx squared. Then there's going to be another one called b in front of dy squared. And then there's going to be a third one, c, c squared, in front of dz squared. And the way to interpret this is to just to imagine that the universe expands at one rate in one direction, another different rate in the second direction, and yet a third in the third direction. And you can well imagine that if we're looking at a situation like this, that there's going to be a shear being generated by the fact that the expansion is, you know, different in all the directions. So that's certainly going to contribute to a shear deformation of our congruence of light rays, and you know, that's why I'm talking about this, just to get something a little bit less simple than what we had before. Now, let's see. So here I'm not assuming anything about this satisfying the Einstein field equations. I don't really care about this. I just make up a metric that wants that does what I want it to do. But if we ask about, you know, how to find you know, functions A, B, and C that would give us a solution to the Einstein field equations, well, it turns out that there's a spacetime that achieves this. It's called the Kasner spacetime. That's a special case to what I'm talking about here, which is actually a vacuum solution to the Einstein field equation. And that we get if we set A to be a power of T, I'll call it alpha, and B would be another power of T, I'll call it beta, and C would be a third power of T, I'll call it gamma. And that by itself is not enough. That's still not going to be a solution to the field equations. But if I put two constraints on alpha and gamma, alpha, beta, gamma, if I say that the sum of those things is equal to 1 and the sum of the squares is equal to 1, then I promise you this is a solution to the Einstein field equations in vacuum. And the way to prove this is to plug that into a calculation of the Einstein tensor and verify that for power laws like this, you only get a zero Einstein tensor if those constraints are satisfied. And the meaning of those constraints here is that, well, we started out with three coefficients, but there's actually, you know, they're all functions of a single parameter. So there's a one parameter way of writing alpha, beta, and gamma so that these constraints are satisfied. So it's basically a one-parameter family of solutions to the Einstein field equations. And for that one independent parameter, we get a solution for any value of that parameter. Anyway.
Is there any physical interpretation of that parameter? Like what changing it does?
That's a good question. I mean, it has to do with curvature, right? Because here we don't have matter, so that doesn't give us a way to interpret the parameters. But we have a Riemann tensor that will have certain components that depend on that parameter, so that would give you a way to characterize the space-time. But yeah, I don't know any more than that. Yeah, so anyway, so that's just a bit of a curiosity, just to show you that it's possible to give some credibility to this, even though, well, there's no particular reason to consider this, given that it doesn't quite describe our universe. But anyway, some people have played various games with this. Okay, so what I'm going to do here, I have to identify some null directions here. I want to identify null surfaces, and there's a ton of freedom here. So I'll take my surfaces to be changing in T and Z, and I'll leave the rest of the metric all alone. So I want to factorize it the way I did before, and I'll use the T and Z part of the metric to do that. So I'll take the null directions to be purely along T and Z. So what I'm going to do here is to factorize. So I'm going to isolate the Z part of the metric with the T part of the metric, and then the rest of it will just come along for the ride. And then what I'm going to do is to factorize this into two null directions. And I'm going to do it in a very specific way. So let me look it up so I don't mess it up. I'm going to factorize a factor of C squared. And then over here, I'm going to have 1 over C times dt. minus dz. And for the second factor, I'm going to get 1 over c times dt plus dz. And then the rest of the metric comes along for the ride. And the idea here is that, well, first of all, this is all equivalent, because if I multiply this by that, I get 1 over c squared dt squared. The factor of c squared is killed. We get the minus 1. And if I, you know, multiply this by that, I get dz squared. With the factor of c squared, I get this. So that's a way to identify the null directions that I'm talking about. And the reason why I'm writing it in this way is because here also I have a perfect differential, and here also I have a perfect differential. This is a function of t integrated with respect to t, so that works. That's z, and so on. So that allows me to identify the surfaces of constant, constant phase, so to speak. So all I'm saying here is that, well, this is the thing that I'm going to call du. And du is a perfect differential, so I can actually write a u corresponding to it. And that's going to be r dv. And what are these things? Well, u is just going to be the integral of dt over c minus z. And v is going to be the integral of dt over c plus z. And those, if we consider motion purely in the t and z direction, those are null directions, because either, if I'm moving along u equal constant, du is going to be, du is going to be zero, and the rest of the metric. So all I'm saying is that if I put, if I put those terms to zero by considering displacement purely along t and z, then I can arrange ds squared to be zero, either by saying that the motion is along u equal constant surfaces or v equal constant surfaces. That sets du equals zero for a null displacement. Okay, so those are my surfaces, and this will describe outgoing, or I should say right moving, light surfaces moving in the positive direction of z. And that would be right moving. Okay, so that's the setup, and it's a bit more exotic, but that's kind of fun. Yeah.
Let's give it twice.
So U is right moving.
Okay.
Yeah. We're going to see that in just a second. Yeah, left and right means positive Z versus negative Z. Okay, so let's work out some of the details. Okay, so I'm going to pick the u equal constant here as the null surfaces we want to focus on. So I'm going to define the vector k to be minus the gradient of that surface, as we have before. And then if I calculate this for the time component with the minus sign, I'm going to get minus 1 over c. And for the z component, I'm going to get the z derivative of u, which is 1 with the extra minus sign. And then, that's the z component. No component along x, no component along y. So that's the k vector, time component, z component. And if I raise the index on this to see what the light rays are doing, then when I raise the index here, the tt component of the metric is minus 1, so I get plus 1 over c. And then, of course, I still get 0 here, 0 here. And then the inverse of the metric in the z direction is going to be 1 over c squared. So that's what I get for the k vector. And what we see here is that, well, the time component is positive, the z component is positive, so that describes light rays that move in the z direction. So dt d lambda is equal to 1 over c, and that can be integrated. And dz d lambda is equal to 1 over c squared. If I want to eliminate lambda, all I have to do is to take the ratio of those two equations. I get that dt dz is going to be 1 over c multiplying c squared, so it's c. And this I can rewrite as dz equals to dt over c. And that means that for these light rays, we get exactly the statement that u is equal to a constant. Wait. Oh, yeah, no, that's right. So z minus this is equal to a constant, and that constant is precisely the u quantity we've introduced before. All right, so that's the description of the light rays in that space-time. And if we want to do the rest of the story, which is to decompose the grad k vector, then we have to identify our second null vector. We're going to use the v light cones in order to do that. So our n vector is going to be proportional to grad v, and that would be almost the same thing we had before, except that the z component will now be minus 1. So when I raise the index, that will give me left moving null rays. And then the problem is that, well, this doesn't quite work in terms of normalization, because if I calculate the scalar product between k and n, multiplying the components of this times that, I'm going to get minus 1 over c squared. Minus 1 over c squared, that's equal to minus 2 over c squared. And that's wrong by a factor of of 2 over c squared. So the right normalization for our null vector is going to be c squared over 2 times what we had previously. So that's the second null vector. And after that, we can decompose everything as we have before. And I'll just tell you what the answer is in terms of the full decomposition. So the full decomposition says that we have this kind of thing, called it B, K alpha, K beta, plus K alpha, B beta perpendicular, plus B alpha perpendicular, K beta. And then I have the fully transverse part of this. So that was the decomposition in full. And if you work it all out, and I'll, you know, leave that for you to do as an exercise, you're going to find that B, which is information that we don't really care about, that's given by C dot, which means the time derivative of C. Doesn't mean very much. We don't care very much about this. That vector is, as we had before, 0. So that's all nice and good. Theta, which we can calculate directly from the divergence of the vector, well, that's the thing that represents the fractional rate of change of the cross-sectional areas. So the cross-sections here are going to be measured by the x and y direction. And here we get something interesting for that. We get 1 over c, a dot over a, plus b dot over b. So the areas are increasing because a and b are changing. But because this refers to, you know, a certain parametrization of the geodesics, there's also a factor of 1 over c that comes with it. So that is the fractional change in area. And basically, there's information that comes from the transverse part of the metric that involves a and b. And finally, there's a non-zero shear in this case because we have a non-uniform, you know, non-isotropic expansion. So the xx component of the shear is given by a squared over 2c And here we get A dot over A minus B dot over B. So that the shear would go to zero if we had the same degree of expansion in both directions. But because there is a difference, the little areas that you can form by bounding them by null geodesics, well, that will be distorted as they travel forward in time, and that's measured by this difference over here. I think it's sort of natural to think of this. And then the yy component of the shear comes with a b squared 2c, and it comes with the opposite difference. So that's an example where there's more going on with the congruence than just an overall expansion. Because we have different expansions in different directions, we also get a shear deformation of the of little bundles of light rays, and that's something that this anisotropy gives us. Otherwise, we wouldn't get it. If I were doing this in FRW, there would be very little going on except for just this overall expansion of the universe that would be, of course, communicated to the null geodesics. But here we get a bit more because the metric has more, there's more stuff going in that metric. Yep.
Here is based on the expected shear as well.
Yeah. And even if we, that's for sure. So zero angular momentum light rays will certainly acquire shear, and for that matter, rotation. As they travel and occur. And that's true also for Schwarzschild, if we're not talking about radial geodesics, but geodesics that also orbit around, they will also develop shear. So shear tends to be pretty common. It's just that when you do the simplest examples, you don't see it because the examples are too simple. Yeah, a lot of the times.
I'm not getting the physical interpretation of the shear.
Well, think of a little square. So suppose that you start at one instant of time on that in that cosmology, and you define a little bundle of light rays by drawing a little square like this. And then what you're going to do is to look at that little square at a later time in the history of the universe, when you had an expansion along one direction that's different from the opposite direction. So that square will become a rectangle, right? If we had equal expansions in all directions, a square would stay a square. We wouldn't get shear. But here, because of that, that figure gets deformed in the evolution. And that, requires different expansions in the two directions, in the two, transverse directions. So that's what the shear is, right? So you look at the bundle of light rays in this case, and you look at the shape of that bundle, and you see how it deforms in time, and that's what the shear measures. The expansion measures how it grows or decays or either grows or shrinks in time.
Right, but my point mostly is what can be inferred about space time from this?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So there, in the vast literature on mathematical relativity, there was a whole story about writing down the congruence of light rays and imposing certain conditions on it, like vanishing shear, and try to find those conditions as ways to find a metric. So you impose those conditions on a congruence. For example, you invoke the existence of a shear-free congruence of null geodesics, and then that tells you something about the structure of space-time that's compatible with that assumption. And there was a big industry in trying to generate exact solutions to the field equations by starting from that kind of point of view, and people took that quite far. So in a sense, it's a way of characterizing the space-time in a way that is made operational by looking at how light rays behave. So a non-zero shear will tell you something about the space-time. A zero shear will tell you something else about the space-time. So you can you can, you know, it's a way of gathering information if you don't have access to the metric. And in fact, it can be a means to construct a metric in this way of doing things.
Yeah, the same way that I'm thinking about data, for example. We look at that to see what's happening to the expansion and then talk about, we are going to talk about those data. But these are not marginalized, not hyper surfaces.
Right, marginally trapped surfaces.
Yeah, I was thinking in the same way that what can we say about the shear?
Yeah, so you know, theta is more, I think, is more immediately revealing, but the shear is also, you know, also contains a lot of important information. It's just that you have to think a little bit harder about it. But yeah, typically the expansion is the thing we're going to use as a diagnostic of horizons, for example. So we're going to see that it plays a very, very prominent role in the description of black holes when we get there. Yep.
Arnold, you made a comment earlier in the first question about the Kerr space-time and how, I guess, like marginally bound or whatever light rates can acquire shear. And I agree with that. But then you said they could acquire rotation. But then that goes back to that question I asked you last week, where we shouldn't, at least the equations say that an initially non-rotation shouldn't be acquiring rotation since it's proportional.
Yeah, I said the words wrong, so I didn't mean acquire rotation. I should have said it possesses rotation.
Right, so right. If it starts with rotation, rotation can change, I guess, but
right.
If it doesn't, then it shouldn't.
That's right. So the evolution equation for the rotation tensor says that if it starts zero, it stays zero. So the correct statement is, you know, give me a congruence in Kerr, I can decide at any given time if there's rotation or not. And if it's true that there's rotation, then there'll be rotation at all times.
Yeah.
Yep.
Still bothering me that example of time-like geodesics. Like if they start marginally bound, if they fall in, they acquire some rotation. They move around with the black hole when they come in. They don't fall straight in. And that seems to me like they're acquiring some rotation
in the course of evolution. Yeah, so I think, that's a good point, and I don't have an immediate resolution to this. I think it would have to, you'd have to look into the detail of this, you know, what is the rotation as a function of a fine parameter and see how it behaves, and, you know, at infinity, how it behaves somewhere else and see how it all works out. I mean, one thing I know is that congruences can be very deceiving. You know, sometimes it's hard to understand what's going on unless you've studied them a lot. And every new situation brings its new challenge, and you know, it's a little bit deceptive sometimes. Okay, other questions about this? Okay, good. So, I hope that those two examples were sort of useful to sort of illustrate what's going on here. We're almost done talking about congruences of null geodesics. The only thing left to do is to go through the Wright-Chaudhuri equation again and think about the focusing theorem in that new context. And that is not going to take us too much time because all the hard work was previously done. All we have to do is to adapt a few things to the null case instead of the time-like case. So I think that's something we can do easily in the remaining 20 minutes. All right, so let's look at Wright-Chaudhuri's equation. And just so that we remember, this is an evolution equation for theta. And the starting point to derive this was an evolution equation for the full gradient tensor. And then if we take the trace of this, we'll get the evolution equation for theta all by itself. So that's a calculation we did previously for the time-like case. And the starting point of that calculation was exactly the same, except that instead of k, we were writing u and u. We were using the normalized tangent vector for the time-like case. And the point is that the initial part of the calculation goes through identically. So we don't have to repeat this. We just, you know, go back to our previous calculation and replace all the u's by k's. And that's the end of that. So if we work through this in the same way, we're going to get that this is equal to minus grad k. I'll write it like this, grad k. So before we had grad u, exactly the same way. And we have a Riemann tensor term that is, again, identical to what we had before, except that instead of having u times u, we have k times k. So that's exactly the same as in the time-like case. All right, so that's good news. No need to repeat all of this. So that was the first step. The second step is that we're going to take the trace, you know, take a contraction between alpha and beta. And if we do that, we're going to have our evolution equation for the divergence of k, which is the same thing as our expansion scalar. So I'll write it like this, but in fact, this is the same thing as the rate of change of the expansion scalar along the null race, so with parameter lambda. So I can write it like this. And if I do this contraction over here, I'm going to get grad k multiplying grad k with a switch in indices. In the general case, we would worry, you know, we would be careful about this switch of order here, but because in our context, grad k is a symmetric tensor, here that switch doesn't mean anything. So I can rewrite it in exactly the same way as here, and that wouldn't change anything. And then other than that, well, we have a contraction between alpha and beta, and that will give us a Ricci tensor. So the Riemann terms, the Riemann term becomes a Ricci term that I can write it like that. So basically the same calculation as before, and again, same result, except that where we had u's before, now we have k's. Okay, so that's all the same as before. The next step, and now we're going to start seeing some changes, what we can do is to plug in the decomposition of grad k into that expression over here. So I still have it over here, so we can import that. So the rate of change of the expansion scalar, that's going to be given by, well, two big things like that. So we have bk alpha k beta plus k alpha b perp beta plus b alpha k beta plus the fully projected version of b. So that's this over here. I've written in, you know, mu in terms of beta, so same difference. And then I would have, in principle, I would have the gradient with the indices changed, but I'm still within the context where that's a symmetric tensor, so I don't care really. So I'm going to write it in exactly the same way. And then I have the Ricci term that I'll write as RKK. And now, in principle, I have a big multiplication to work through, but that's going to turn out very easy because, you know, you go through the multiplication and K multiplies K at zero. K multiplies K at zero. K multiplies K at zero. And finally, this is orthogonal to K, so all of those terms vanish. So all of those guys multiplied together give us zero. Now moving on here, we have k multiplying k at zero. k multiplying k that's 0. Here we have k orthogonal to b, so that's 0, b orthogonal to k, that's 0. And then we're left over here, but then k is orthogonal to b alpha beta, so that's 0. So basically, all the terms will vanish except for this multiplying that. So if we keep going, we have k multiplying k, we have k multiplying b, that's 0, k multiplying k, that's 0, k multiplying b alpha beta, that's 0. So the only thing that survives is going to be b multiplying b. And then we have the Ricci term. And now, well, all that's left to do is to insert the trace versus trace-free decomposition of b, and we're going to have our Ricci-Auderi equation. So b is going to be 1 half theta projection operator plus sigma, and that multiplies 1 half sigma alpha beta plus sigma alpha beta, and then we get minus r alpha k beta. And again, we have some multiplication to work through, but most of them are going to be 0. So here we get 1 half 1 half, that's a quarter. We get theta squared, and we get omega times omega, and that gives us a factor of 2. If you remember, omega is, you know, the metric minus n times k, k times n. So when you take the trace of all this, you get 4 minus 1 minus 1, that's a 2. So we get 1 half, 1 half, 2. So we get 1 half theta squared, and that's this multiplying that. And then after that, a whole bunch of zeros. So sigma times omega, that's 0. Sigma times omega, that's 0 from the trace-free condition. And finally, we're down to this.
Missing a minus sign.
And I'm missing an overall minus sign. That's good, because otherwise I would have been in trouble. So what's Ricci-Auderi's equation in the null context? We have that the rate of change of the expansion scalar, which is itself measuring the fractional rate of change of cross-sectional areas, that's going to be equal to minus half theta squared plus sigma alpha beta, plus r alpha, k beta. So that's Ricci-Auderi's equation. And, you know, I keep promising you that this is one of the most insightful equations of all of gravitational physics. It was partially true in the time-like case because of all the extra conditions that we had to invoke to make it do something useful. But here, you know, there's less to worry about. So the gradient vector field guarantees that the omega term is 0, so we don't have to impose that as an extra condition that was built in. And what do we have? Well, we have something that's obviously positive, obviously positive. The only, you know, thing that remains to be, you know, examined a little bit here is the sign of that Ricci term. In the, you know, in the time-like case, we had Ricci times u, and in order to force that to be positive, we had to come up with some strange conditions on the stress tensor, and that condition, the strong energy condition, is something that's violated by the cosmological constant. So that's something that was a little bit, you know, of a concern when we formulate the focusing theorem in the time-like case. But in the null case, well, we're going to see that this translates into a very simple condition on the stress tensor, and we're going to see that it's much more natural and much more, you know, plausible to impose it as a condition on matter. And then we're going to have a very clean, very nice formulation of the focusing theorem with less questionable assumptions. The assumption about, you know, the absence of a rotation tensor that would produce a term with the wrong sign, that's something that comes from free from the geometric optics approximation. So as long as you have a physical field that, you know, gives you those null geodesics, you're covered. So that makes the whole thing, no, very nice. So what do we need for a focusing theorem? Well, we just need to convince ourselves that, you know, under most conditions, everything on the right-hand side is going to be negative. And then we have what we need. So the only questionable thing, as I said, is the sign of the Ricci term. So that, you know, so as I said, this is necessarily non-negative. It's the square of something. This is the square of a tensor that only has spatial components being orthogonal to both K and N. The only directions left to it are purely space-like directions. So it's a purely space-like tensor. And therefore, the square of a purely space-like tensor is guaranteed to be non-negative. And therefore, the only thing that we have to worry about is the sign of that one. But if we can guarantee that this is also non-negative, then on the right-hand side, we have something that's negative. And therefore, we have the statement that even though the expansion itself can be positive, it will evolve toward smaller values in the future evolution of the congruence. So geodesics can fly apart, but they will fly apart less rapidly in the future. If they are already contracting, they will contract all the way down to a singularity of the congruence. That's the focusing theorem. So the focusing theorem is the theorem that says that this is necessarily negative, which means that theta will decrease in future. So if it starts positive, it will, if it's greater than zero, it will decrease. Well, it decreases in all cases. If it starts positive, it will get less positive as the course of the evolution. And then if it starts negative, it will become even more negative in the course of the evolution. So geodesics can fly apart, but they will fly apart less rapidly in the future. Or geodesics starting converging together will converge more rapidly together in the future, and eventually they will meet into some kind of singularity of the flow where the expansion will become, so this is the case where theta is positive, this is the case where theta is negative, and here we have what's known as a caustic, which means a singularity of the flow. And that's a point where theta goes to minus infinity. And what do we need to formulate this focusing theorem? Well, all we need is a condition, and it's still called the Ricci condition. A condition that says that this component of the Ricci tensor for whatever spacetime we're dealing with is positive. And we could leave this, you know, at that we could leave it as a condition on the Ricci tensor. But if we work in GR, we can re-express the Ricci tensor in terms of the stress tensor of the matter. We've done this before. If we do this, then the Ricci condition is turned into an energy condition. And what is that? Well, this becomes 8 pi T alpha beta minus half T G alpha beta. So that's the Ricci tensor re-expressed in terms of the stress tensor of matter. We're still contracting with the K vector. We're still demanding that this be positive. But here we see a beautiful thing. We see G KK, which is zero because K is a null vector. In the time-like case, this was a big nuisance because G times U is minus one, and we were getting this strange combination of T alpha beta and T, the trace of T as part of the energy condition that was, you know, coming out of all this. And it was a rather awkward thing, and things, you know, it was that condition that we couldn't guarantee would always be satisfied by, you know, normal matter. But here, a beautiful thing is that we actually get rid of this term because K is a null vector. So what's left over? Well, the energy condition that's left over is basically a very plausible requirement on the stress tensor that says that its contraction with K has to be zero. And basically, you can consider this to be the limiting case where you have an observer moving with the speed of light, measuring the density of matter to be positive. So it's basically just, well, there's a bit more to it than that, but it's basically just a requirement that densities, you know, energy density measured by an observer approaching the speed of light be positive. So this is really a condition on positive energy density. And that turns out to be far more difficult to violate than the strong energy condition. And what this means is that, well, the null version of the focusing theorem is a lot stronger and holds under much stronger, weaker conditions. I should put it like this. It holds more naturally, you know, under a wider regime of circumstances than the time-like version. So it's really a much better description of the focusing aspects of gravity if you apply it to null geodesics as opposed to time-like geodesics. There's less involved in terms of arbitrary choices for the conditions to impose on the theorem. So either you think of it as a condition on the Ricci tensor, or through the Einstein field equations, we think of it as a condition on the stress energy tensor of matter. And the point is always that in order to get a focusing theorem, we have to impose fewer things that seem, you know, arbitrary than in a time-like case, and therefore it gives us a much stronger, you know, view of things. So geodesics can fly apart, but it will fly apart less rapidly in the future, or they can be converging, and then when they converge, they will generate a singularity of the flow, and that's basically the statement all over again that, well, the thing that produces this, you know, negative acceleration between nearby geodesics is gravity, and gravity is attractive. And it doesn't seem too crazy to think that in order to, you know, have an attractive behavior for gravity, that matter should cooperate and produce energy densities that are positive. You know, it wouldn't be too surprising to think that negative energy density would produce repulsive gravity. And sure enough, we see the immediate connection between these things in the focusing theorem, all coming out of Ray Chowdhury's equation. So to me, that's just a beautiful result. It has a ton of implications that I won't have time to go into, but you know, there's a major application of all those results coming in the description of horizons. I don't think I have, I think it's getting late and I don't think I have the energy left to go into a little bit of this. Well, I'll just say a couple of words just to close off the lecture. So when we're talking about event horizons of stationary black holes, we're talking about null surfaces. That's the causal boundary between the inside of the black hole and the outside of the black hole. So we know that in the description of the black hole, we're going to be dealing with some kind of null surface. And if we're dealing with some kind of null surface, we know that that surface is going to be traced by null geodesics of some kind. And the vector k, which is normal to the event horizon, will be tangent to those geodesics. If we want to describe the behavior of the event horizon as a whole, as I keep saying, what we need to do is to look at the relative behavior of one geodesic relative to the next one. And if we see them flying apart, then that's an indication. And in fact, you can see it right away that if the geodesics are flying apart, that means that the horizon itself is expanding. And that would be the situation encountered when the black hole is growing. If the black hole is not growing, if the black hole has stopped feeding, then you would expect the horizon of the black hole to stay still, to not grow in time. And that would mean, in meaningful terms, that those geodesics are no longer flying apart. They're basically standing still relative to one another. So we're talking about null geodesics in that spacetime that have a transverse behavior that is completely still. There's no relative motion between those neighboring null geodesics. So to get a stationary black hole, one that doesn't grow in size, we need the expansion scalar to be zero. And if nothing will ever change in time, that's also going to be true that its rate of change will be zero. Right? If nothing is to grow in time, if nothing is changing with time, nothing depends on time. Therefore, theta is zero, no relative motion, and no change in that relative motion. Well, okay, so if we accept this, then we have a situation where Ray Chowdhury's equation tells us that this is zero, this is zero. So what's left over? Well, a sum of two terms, one being positive, the other one being imposed to be positive by the premises of the focusing theorem. If this is non-negative, this is non-negative, then we have a sum of non-negative numbers being zero. If you think of how this can happen, well, it's got to be true that each term individually is zero. So if we want to achieve all of this, we have to impose that the square of the shear tensor be separately zero, so that its square is itself zero. And if the energy condition holds, we also have to impose that, well, I'll write it as the Ricci condition. We have to impose that the Ricci term by itself vanishes. So here I'm taking the point of view that this has to be non-negative, and the only way that it can be zero, that the whole left-hand side here be zero, so the only way that I can arrange the left-hand side to be zero is for two non-negative numbers to be separately zero. If I didn't have control over the sign of this, I could say that the positive sigma squared could be compensated by a negative Ricci term. So that is not something I want to consider. What I want to consider is a situation where this is guaranteed to be non-negative, and then the only way that I can add two non-negative numbers together to get zero is if they're both zero. So that tells me that if I want to describe a horizon, I have to impose all of those conditions altogether, otherwise it just wouldn't work. Stationary horizons. And that turns out to be incredibly restrictive. So horizons are not just any old null surfaces. In order to describe a stationary black hole horizon, the null hypersurface has to be so special so as to enforce all of those conditions individually, separately, one by one. So it tells us that, something very deep about horizons that we don't even need a metric to describe, right? So those are deep geometrical facts about horizons that we get from Ray Chowdhury's equation. And those are very important things that we can say about black hole horizons without having to stare at any particular solution like Kerr or Schwarzschild. Those are deeper geometrical things that don't require a metric for their description. So that's the promise of Ray Chowdhury's equation, and as we go through the course, we'll see that coming back and playing a very useful role for us.
Yep. Can I have a question?
Yes. Go first. Yep.
It is the definition of horizon to have these conditions, or horizon imposes these conditions?
So the horizon means that we're dealing with a null surface. But if we want the horizon, so there are more conditions than this. It has to be a causal boundary between an inside of a black hole and the outside. The key word here is that we're talking about a stationary horizon, one that doesn't evolve in time. So if we're describing a black hole that's sitting still, doesn't absorb any matter or do anything like that, then the key property is a stationary black hole horizon, and that's where all of those properties come out.
Okay, we will cover this part, I think, in a more comprehensive way later on, right?
Yeah, so that's just a teaser for what we're going to be doing in a few weeks. Yep. Yep, you have a question?
Thank you.
Did you do a perturbative analysis of the black hole horizon starting off with the Ricci equation?
Yeah, in fact, that's something that a lot of people have done in the past, including me, where you can look at things that are second order. They start at zero, but now you can start perturbing them and introduce first order deviations and see what this translates into in terms of how the area grows and what's causing the area to grow and all of this. And we'll probably do some of that also in the next few weeks. Okay, good. So thank you. So I think that's enough for today, and we'll do something else next week.